Did you know that overlooked health problems are not only humanitarian crises, but also missed investment opportunities? Imagine a world where treatments for diseases disproportionately affecting underserved populations become blockbusters, improving lives and generating massive returns. This is the vision of today's guest.
Or we're leaving money on the table, but not looking at and not seriously investing in, you know, women-led companies, diverse, you know, black and brown CEOs and led companies. We're leaving money on the table. Our mission is to accelerate health equity and obviously while generating returns for investors. And we do that essentially by deploying capital into therapies that treat diseases that disproportionately impact an underserved population.
Exactly. There's no shortcut for success.
Squire Servance is the founder of Zurich Bio, a venture capital firm making a difference. They are not just investing in potentially profitable healthcare solutions, but in companies specifically tackling health disparities. Discover in this episode a new approach to investing where doing good and doing well go hand in hand. In this episode, we explore the untapped potential, learn how health equity opens up massive overlooked markets. We are addressing disparities to understand the systemic causes behind inequitable healthcare access and how investment can change that. We are also looking into the power of diversity, why investing in founders from diverse backgrounds can lead to better outcomes for everyone. Data-driven decisions is the next point. See how Squire Servance evaluates companies to ensure both impact and potential for success. And at the end, we dive deep into the founders' mindsets, get actionable advice for entrepreneurs seeking investment and building sustainable healthcare businesses. If you are a founder, CEO, or investor who believes in the power of innovation to address society's biggest challenges, this episode is for you. Subscribe, comment, and share to be part of a community dedicated to transformative investing. This conversation with Squire Servance is filled with valuable insights on the intersection of health equity and smart venture capital. Enjoy the show. The flying start. Before I forget it. And in 2020, when the pandemic started, Zoom added the webinar option. And I thought, how cool is that? Because before I used the normal Zoom rooms. And when I had 20 or 30 guests at the beginning of the pandemic in a Zoom call, which was intended to be a podcast recording, it was basically a mess. It was simply impossible to organize that. Someone left the microphone open, the other one turned the camera on and off and stuff like that. And when I discovered the Zoom webinar room, it was for me a revelation. It was a blessing because suddenly I could separate the crowd.
You can separate the crowd. You can figure out who's a panelist. You can turn mics on and off and apparently videos too. So no.
Yeah, but the video thing, the funny thing is Zoom is changing the administrator site, I think, every 1 or 2 months. They add new features, they take old features away. And every time it feels like every time when I prepare for a new webinar, there is something different on this page. And this is this tiny little thing to make you miss this checkbox and suddenly you have a completely unexpected result.
No, I completely understand that.
So how is life? You are in New Jersey these days.
Yes, I'm in New Jersey. In Philadelphia right now, but I'm in New Jersey generally. It's where my office is.
Philadelphia is beautiful, beautiful. I loved it. I was with the Bio International, I think it was in 2019, the last time I spent some days in Philadelphia. It was...
Yeah, matter of fact, Life Sciences PA, which I think it used to be Bio PA or PA mm-hmm. Bio, they actually had their conference the last couple of days. So I was out, well, they were outside of Philly in like King of Prussia, if you're familiar with that area. But I love the city. Worked here for a number of years. It's really great, great place.
And your headquarters is in New Jersey.
Yeah, Princeton, specifically.
How is New Jersey?
Oh, I love it. So I'm biased though. So I was born, raised. So my My family is, it's like for the most part from like North Jersey. I was for the most part born and raised in South Jersey. I live in Princeton, which is Central Jersey. So it's a beautiful state. It's the Garden State. I welcome anyone to come by. It's a great place to live, work, and play.
What would you rank, even in case I visit New Jersey, hopefully in a couple of months, what would you recommend for a tourist visit? What should
I
visit?
You have kids? You have children that are coming? So, no, well, no. All right. Well, then you're going to want to go to, I think Newark has an amazing, there's like a New Jersey Symphony up there. Princeton obviously has a lot of stuff going on, great restaurant scene. Jersey City, Hoboken, those are all up north Jersey areas right across from New York, have a lot of great restaurants, a lot of things to do. And so you can't go wrong. Like if it was more family friendly, Central Jersey has a lot of farms and hay rides and now all that stuff is picking up and pumpkin patches and all that good stuff. I have two little ones. So that's my life and my weekend most weekends.
That's great. And what brought you into the life science area? What inspired you to move in that direction?
Yeah. So interestingly, I think it's a great question. So I did a report or project in sixth grade. Winslow Township Elementary School, school number 5, with my teacher, Ms. McCarthy. And we did a presentation on, she asked everyone to go outside and research an occupation. And I researched orthopedic surgeons. That's where I landed on. I'm like, man, you get to work with athletes. It's in the sciences. And from that point on, I can tell you, I can pinpoint it. So from that point on, I was hooked on the sciences and what you could do, how you can help people, the intricacies of, you know, neuroscience and biology. And so I've wanted to be in this space since I was a little kid.
As sixth grader, it's 16, 17 years old, is it? I mean, no, I'm from Europe,
sixth,
from Australia.
Yeah, sixth grade, no, what is that? I don't know. 12, 11, somewhere around there.
Yeah. Why did you decide to interview orthopedic surgeons?
You know, it was, you're young. Well, I'm young at the time. I thought it was really cool that they get to work with athletes. I'd like that intersection, trying to be athletic at the time. And I thought that was pretty cool. I saw that how much they were making. I was like, oh man, you can make that much. Now I didn't know anything about investment banking and venture funds and entrepreneurship. I didn't know anything about that. But when I saw the intersection of what they were doing and how much they were making, and really the sports angle was probably one of the bigger pieces. That's what led me to it. And so that was like the starting point. But then I got to learn more. I started taking more courses. And the love just kind of grew from there.
This is amazing. When I was 11, I was inspired mostly by computers and learned about people like Steve Jobs and Bill Gates and found it very interesting. And you basically live in the motherland of capitalism and investment entrepreneurship. How did you then transition? I mean, from the start, you interviewed orthopedic surgeons, then you went to university, to college, you graduated, and then you decided to go into venture capital. What sparked this interest to go into investment side?
Yeah, no. So I'll give you like the full rundown of how it ultimately played out. So focused on the life sciences from an early age, ended up going to college. I double majored in college, biomedical engineering. My second one was major was cell biology and neuroscience. Ultimately pivoted because the plan was actually to go to medical school. Ultimately pivoted from that. Just felt like that wasn't for me as I kind of grew, but still loved the sciences and ended up going into law school and business school. And when I graduated, I ultimately became a patent attorney. So I was a patent attorney doing work in the life sciences space. And so I was able to marry my love of the science with the practice of law, and which I thought was it was a great combination. And so when you're working at a pretty large firm here in Philadelphia, and once you get build the expertise of building patent portfolios, helping companies, life sciences companies, create value. It was a great transition in doing license work, collaboration, partnerships, M&As. And that's where I got exposure to the investments and working with, doing transactions with VC companies, entrepreneurs. And that's where, I felt that it was around that time when I was at the law firm, I knew I really wanted to go into the venture world at some point. We're doing transactions, I'm getting an hourly rate. I'm seeing what the checks are getting cut to the entrepreneurs, to the VC fund, seeing their multiples. I was like, man, I'm on the wrong side of this transaction here. And so I was fortunate. I knew a gentleman who's in the VC space. And I remember sitting down with him for lunch one day. And I'm like, look, I want to do what you do. And he's kind of laid out the groundwork. He said, okay, if you want to do this, you have to go in-house. You have to go work for some companies, do business development. He recommended that I ultimately transition over to kind of to the business. But my path took me up on the legal side of things a little bit. And so I ultimately became in C-suite as a general counsel and corporate secretary of a life sciences company. But he recommended and gave me, here are the things that if you're trying to do what I'm doing, here are the things you should be doing. And here are the jobs you need to take over the next 7 to 8 years. And for the most part, I followed that roadmap. And so it's interesting, people say, is this something that, just came out of the blue because you switch from law to investments, but it actually was, almost a decade in the making. And so I knew it was coming. It was just a matter of the right time, the right thesis, and the right approach.
I have a lot of young scientists in the audience, and I know from some that they are not so intrigued by the idea to pursue an academic career and are looking for other directions in life. Could you break down the advice you got and your experience into the 7 steps to venture capitalists for young people? How would it look like if you tried it?
No. So I'll give my experience and then kind of I could provide some other context for others that are junior. So what I was told was, and it was ultimately kind of go do your own thing. You have to build up a track record of doing deals, right? And so if you're not, I was already in my professional career, I already had my MBA. And so for me to pivot from a legal background to venture fund, I'd have to be able to say, here are the deals that I did. Here were the returns on investment, where they are accretive to, adjusted earnings per share, and have to have that experience so that when I did go to market, I can talk about it and say, this is the type of work that I've done, and here's my track record of success. And so I think if anyone's pivoting from, from like a legal field or something like that over, that would be my recommendation. So, if you look at what I did is I went to business development, I did deals, right? Then I was associate general counsel at Baxter Healthcare. I was like head of legal for their pharma business. There's a $2 billion business, and I did a number of deals helping to grow their portfolio inorganically through acquisitions and whatnot. And then even when I was a general counsel, at a company, it was very acquisitive. We did 3 company acquisitions. We were averaging like 3 company acquisitions a year. And so
that's a lot of work.
It was a lot of work. It was real busy time. Now for those like scientists, it's interesting because like in the life sciences space, specifically life sciences investments, that PhD is, highly valued. Having someone that can speak the science, we can figure out collectively with you the business side of things, but there is a path, and a lot of people, I think I'm a big advocate. If you don't want to go into academia, or if you don't focus on R&D and you want to kind of go invest, it's a great pivot, and the work is needed. You can start off whether it's in analysts helping to analyze deals, and then kind of work your way up in the VC realm.
What inspired you then to start your own fund? I mean, you can imagine you had a great career, you had big corporation. So there are the advantages to work with Baxter, and probably also some, just imagining some offers from other big companies with your, given your expertise, then you pivoted to venture capital. What inspired you then to start your own fund and not just lean back and say, okay, where is the next big fund that I can join? And everything is laid out already. What inspired you to become an entrepreneur again?
No. And so, because I had the idea for the fund, the question was the timing. So I knew I was going to do it at some point. And what really happened was, you know, we go through COVID. You start to see health disparities front and center on the television every night. Now, look, I grew up in definitely in my community, in the Black community that I was associated with, kind of growing up, my family, we always talked about health disparities. It was understood that these disparities existed. But it was quite interesting during COVID to see it front and center on the TV. No one could hide from it anymore. You had more Black and Hispanic people dying, going to the hospital, getting sick, staying out of work longer. Like, that's what the data. And at that point in time, I was trying to figure out, like, okay, what can we do? What can I do personally to help try to address this issue in some way? And so ultimately try to figure out a way to combine addressing health equity with this fund idea. And that's kind of where we landed. The timing of it was, I don't think there's any particularly great time to kind of go out and do something this large. I was fortunate, you know, I have a supportive family. We kind of talked it over with my wife, and we were like, well, this is a good time to do it. I had pretty, you know, a successful legal career to date, and I felt comfortable taking at least a career risk at the time to get the company off the ground.
You mentioned the term health equity. When you look back at your pharma career, how did your perception of health inequalities, health equity change over the years? Where are we today, and how did it evolve over the past years?
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
You love listening to podcasts, but have you ever thought about starting your own podcast? Maybe you want to build a brand, grow your business, or are looking for an excuse to talk about your favorite hobby. Whatever your reason for making a podcast, Buzzsprout is the place to start. Since 2009, Buzzsprout has helped over 300,000 people launch their own podcasts. Buzzsprout walks you step by step through the whole process and will give you powerful tools to start, grow, and monetize your podcast. Ready to get started? Click the link in the show notes to get our free step-by-step guide to starting your podcast today.
Well, I think it's evolved in the sense that there's more structure around what that means, right? So people could talk about health equity and health disparities, but a lot of times it was undefined. As a matter of fact, there still isn't really one common definition of what that means. I describe it as, you know, health equity. It's a state where everyone has the fair and just opportunity to attain their highest level of health, right? Or describe as social justice in healthcare. And I think it now you kind of go out and you see what's going on out there, and they have, you know, what goes into health equity, the social determinants of health, and what that means. So there's a lot more structure and a lot more research and a lot more focus on this. And I think, like, for example, COVID accelerated the development and, you know, like mRNA technology, for example, it accelerated, you know, the understanding of why health equity is an issue and why it needs to be at the forefront of many companies, government, state and federal government's minds.
What are the most pressing health disparities you observe in the United States?
So in the United States, I would, you know, obviously the big ones like racial ethnic disparities. That's like a big one where you can just look at the life expectancy of Black and Native Americans for that compared to white Americans. It's just, there's a big gap. You can look at, Black women are maternal mortality, right? Black women are three times more likely to die from pregnancy related complications. So like just from racial ethnic disparities, you see that. You also see issues around access to healthcare, right? Well, you know, US, we don't have universal healthcare here. We won't get into the politics around that, but, you know, that makes an issue with respect to access to quality care for a number of folks. And that's just not like people, you know, healthcare and access to it. It's not necessarily limited to like urban centers and things like that, but it's rural communities that now may make difficult to get to, you know, hospital centers and things like that. So those are just, and it is a very large and complex issue. I can go into chronic diseases. I can go into mental health, but there are a number of big issues that, that we're facing here in the United States that, from just a health equity standpoint, are big issues that hopefully, you know, folks will be able to focus on and try to address in the future.
If we would narrow down the list and say, what are the three biggest disparities that we should change to improve the situation, which three would that be that have the highest impact?
Well, man, that's a loaded question. Because like, it's a loaded question because you have to understand why there's health inequity first, right? Mm. If you understand that, so you have health inequity, what I was saying, like that state where everyone fair and just opportunity to attain their healthy living, right? Then you have what goes into that social determinants of health. What is actually, you know, you have economic stability, environment, education, access to quality healthcare, and like community engagement, right? Those are like pillars. Now, again, there's no one set definition of what all those are, but those go into it. And then you have the structural reasons why there are issues in transportation, issues in housing, right? And so you have to dig a lot deeper. And there's no, that's just why there's no one solution here to address such a weighty issue. So I can't give you those top three things. Because it's going to take a concerted effort from our elected officials, a concerted effort from, you know, private companies, public companies, nonprofits, churches, community organizers. It's a breadth of folks that really need to be engaged to if you want to start moving the needle in that space.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. There's, I mean, where people are sick, there are a lot of problems. Also here in Europe, I think the system is changing. It's especially, I mean, it's becoming particularly expensive in the last years with an aging population. And we also see these disparities popping up. And sometimes I think I did a lot of research myself in longevity, but coming more from the martial arts side. So I started in the 80s, 90s, and when I decided not to study medicine, the reason was that nobody tackled the question, how can we stay healthy, basically. So at the university level, it was mostly about healing diseases and curing diseases and nothing about how to stay healthy. And when I look at our society, I think nutrition, sedentary lifestyle, no exercise, add a lot. And the difference between educated people with access to education, and people who don't have it is just, I mean, when they look at people, what they eat and what they drink, it's clear that they develop some diseases.
Yeah, exactly. That's why when question I'll get asked is, you know, what's the underlying root, right? Mm-hmm. And you could look at socioeconomic factors, like just purely like simple, it's like a simple example. Lower income individuals often face issues and barriers to accessing quality healthcare, right? Healthy food. Those are educational opportunities, right? Those are all things that just lower income people face on barriers to access. And that plays into why ultimately, if you can't have access to healthy food, how are you expected to attain a healthy life? Right. And then you have just broader structural racism and discrimination. And I'll speak in the United States. Right. Just historically, there are disparities have been perpetuated. Right. And access to education, employment, housing, things like that, specifically tied to one's race. And so once you have that longstanding issue in the United States, it feeds into the social determinants of health, which feeds into why there's health disparities, why there isn't health equity. There currently isn't health equity at this point, right?
Yeah, it's interesting. Yesterday in Austria, there was a speech from a politician. It was in a private circle and somebody filmed it. And they were talking about that in Austria, every child has access to food. So nobody must suffer hunger or doesn't have anybody to eat, anything to eat. And his example was that the cheapest meal for kids in Austria is a burger at a chain we all know and French fries. And as I mean, when you feed that to kids 6, 7, 8 years old, and you say, yeah, you have your warm meal here. You don't need to suffer from hunger and you have enough to eat. And then you look 20 years in the future, when it's clear that this is not going very well.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And, you know, there's probably parallels in the United States specifically around that example.
You have similar developments that...
Yeah, like, you know, people, it's not that everyone, like even there are kids in the United States that go to school hungry because they don't have food right now. Really? Some schools provide it. Some schools don't. You know, sometimes, you know, the food that is provided isn't necessarily the healthiest. And I'm not knocking the system because there's a lot of challenges. And there's a lot of funding issues around trying to do that, provide, you know, healthy foods for folks. But it's an issue that ultimately impacts community health, you know, certain communities' health.
So poverty for children is also an issue. So you said kids go hungry to school in the morning. Did you see an increase in poverty during the pandemic? Is there, when you look at the statistics?
Yeah, I don't know the numbers around that. I know there's significant impact in lower income neighborhoods on a variety of different metrics. You know, folks may not have access to internet, right? How can you do, you know, remote classes if your internet is choppy, right? You can't go out. A lot of communities, I lived in Chicago when this first happened, and, you know, the local neighborhood, the store shut down. You know, I was fortunate I had a car I can go drive to get food, but if you couldn't, you know, if you didn't have a car, it was now difficult for you to get food. And so there are a lot of issues like that. Now, I can't speak to everything, some of my experiences that I've seen I'm here, but yeah, I'm sure there were some really large challenges in the United States broadly around that.
Oh, that's a pity to hear. I thought that we can lower these problems over the years, and it's also in recent years, also in Europe, I think these problems are becoming more pressing, more and more pressing. Mm-hmm. When we look at venture capital and the venture landscape in health equity, how has the perception in the venture world been shaped in the last years around this topic?
Around health equity or just the venture? So it all depends on how you characterize it, right? So I've seen there are certain funds and investment firms that they're focused on health equity, but it's less around what we're doing on, which is investing and financing therapies that treat diseases in the most underserved, you know, communities, right? They're disproportionately affecting underserved communities, right? So you have that aspect, but then you have others that are focused on diverse teams, you know, healthcare companies led by diverse teams. Both instances, look, the investors care about returns. And if you can make a compelling case, a business case, thesis, investment thesis, that investing in a specific way will generate you, you know, 3, 5, 10x return on your capital in a specific period of time, you'll be fine. I think what's the broader trend less in venture funds, it's less around health equity and life sciences and what have you, but it's more just it's more around, you know, there's this cycle of capital scarcity, which is happening now because there's less IPOs and the implications of that downstream. And so it's I think people will invest in a fund that will make money, period.
How do you see the venture landscape these days? When it comes to LPs, is capital flowing to the market, or are we still somewhere in nowhere land where nobody knows what will happen to us?
It's the latter, right? So it is. So, you know, this is what I was saying, the cycle of, you know, capital scarcity. So you have this, and this is kind of what happened here. You have the IPO market kind of dried up. And so, you know, private companies didn't have access to the capital. The VCs looked at that and they say, okay, well, we need to keep our money in house and make sure that we can deploy it to our existing portfolio companies, which means the, you know, the companies that haven't been invested by VCs into VCs are now having trouble raising capital, right? You couple the fact in another kind of outcome of the drier, the broader biotech public equities dip is that from an LP standpoint, the asset allocations now are off, right? So a lot of the big thing in investing from an LP pension funds, that standpoint is, you know, getting that asset allocation correct. And so if you, it's called the denominator problem, right? So if you have, 10% allocated to venture funds in your portfolio, and you, for example, keep it simple, 90% public equities, and now that public equity took a dip, so that value has gone down, that 10% VC market, your allocation is now like 15, 20%, unrelated to anything that the VCs have done. It's all tied to just what's happening on the public markets. And so you have LPs saying, all right, well, we have to balance our portfolio. We're not taking on more VC new managers because we need to wait this thing out until we get our balance back. And so that's really what's been happening in the market here. So you're getting, so funds broadly are having trouble raising capital. Companies are now having trouble raising capital. I think at some point it'll pivot back. I think you'll start to see more IPOs coming back into the market Q1 of next year. And hopefully things will start, cycling back. But that's where we're at from a landscape perspective.
We had a similar topic this morning with Owen Reynolds from Techless Ventures. He's from the US, migrated to Europe. Some people do that. And we touched on that. And he also mentioned that we had two IPOs recently, Arm and Instacart. And when I look at the dynamics, I mean, I hope I remember it right. The latest post I've read on LinkedIn about the Instacart IPO was that the latest investors on the private market in the last round before the IPO got a 75% cut in their valuation. So, I mean, when this hits the balance sheets then of the VCs and they report it back to their LPs and say, I mean, yeah, we recovered 25%. What's your opinion? How will that be taken by LPs? Could that motivate them to put more money into the market?
Sorry, can you repeat that last question? Sorry.
With Instacart, I remember that the valuation cut from the last private round to the IPO valuation was about 75%. So the investors lost money. And I was just thinking, I mean, what's the message to LPs when we have such IPOs?
Well, I mean, there's no crystal ball on how companies are going to play out. The markets are, for the most part, try to be efficient. When I talk to LPs, it's generally that, and you have to describe how you view IPOs. I kind of generally view it as just, it's another fundraising mechanism, right? The way I focus, definitely in the life sciences space, because I get questions around, you're focused on health equity. How big is that market? What does that mean? And we kind of define these health equity diseases where there's a great health disparity on a variety of different dimensions. But when we look at it, it's a global market. The diseases that we're looking at just financially from a global market share perspective are over $500 billion. So it is a big market where we're playing in right now. And we couple that with the fact that our strategy is specifically around venture creation. So acquiring assets, acquiring products and building companies. And we're in a place now where I think around 66, 67% of CEOs at biotech and pharma companies are looking to divest products. So there's a great market to acquire products for us. We think it's going to be a great opportunity to for exits in the future, given how the landscape of biotech and pharma is playing out. The big drivers are it's about $200 billion of revenue at risk tied to patent expirations over the next 7 to 10 years. And there's gaps in pharma company pipelines. And so you have access to products now, 3 to 7 years, we think is the opportune time where, you know, pharma companies, biotech are to deploy their, you know, they're sitting on a lot of cash now and deploy that cash to fill the gaps in their pipeline. And so when I talk to LPs, that's the conversation that I'm having around the landscape, specifically in life sciences space.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, the market is down. This is always the best time to invest. I mean, the valuations are low. 2 years ago, the valuations were just mesmerizing. I think also on public markets, are the public life science companies that are pre-market. I think the CRISPR Intellia 60% down from the peak.
Yeah. So that, you know, for me, it creates opportunities, right? So market dislocation happened. And so like there, you had a lot of pharma companies that, so 2020 and 2021, I want to say majority of the biotech companies that went public were pre-commercial. A number of them were pre-clinical. So, and when you're looking at that, what should be moving the value of the stock price should be data, right? It should be good data. But what happened was there was a lot of things that were bumping up those stocks that were unrelated to kind of the data that was actually getting presented. And so we had a correction, and those individuals, momentum investors, those weren't looking specifically at the data, they kind of got out. And so you have these depressed prices now. And you know, it's a interesting scenario. So like for a fund like me, this is probably why companies are looking to partner with us as far as us taking on assets and taking them forward is, you know, look, now they thought they were going to go raise capital in the markets, and that has dried up. And so they may have had 5 products in their portfolio. They really, you know, they really can fund 3 now based off of what they have. 2 of them, which are, you know, are really good, but, you know, they just have to prioritize their portfolio. Rather than shelving them, they're looking for partners to acquire, take them forward. And that's where our fund comes in. And we've had a number of conversations with different companies and different therapeutic areas where that was exactly the case. And so, you know, it hurts for some of the biotech companies that have to do that. But, you know, and I'm not the only one from a venture creation standpoint looking at the market like this. So, but for us, there's a lot of opportunities. And you mentioned before, but it's like, yeah, buy low, sell high, right? There's a lot of opportunities to acquire. So you have some flexibility and some negotiation leverage now to kind of get some assets at a discount.
And people need money. So it's basically the double opportunity.
Exactly.
Slashed valuations and desperate people is always a good combination for investors. I mean, sorry to say so, but it's the truth of the market. Let's dive a little bit deeper into your fund, in your model, in your investment model. You mentioned that you go in early, you partner with companies, and your goal is to change the problem around health equity and health disparities. Can you explain to the listeners how your model works, how you, from the point where you pick up opportunities to the point where you exit opportunities?
Yeah. So launched a firm called Ceridex Bio last year. We're an impact-minded life sciences venture firm. Our mission is to accelerate health equity. And obviously while generating returns for investors, and we do that essentially by deploying capital into therapies that treat diseases that disproportionately impact an underserved population. So we're like any traditional firm, but our starting point is, where is there a big health disparity by indication? We're looking at lupus, sickle cell, sarcoidosis, triple negative breast cancer. Where are those big health disparities by indication? And then we do more of a pool model. We scour the world to see if there are technologies, drugs, therapies that we can invest in to get them to market. We typically focus on assets that are going into clinical stage or about to be in clinical development already. And so that's our focus. And you know, we're focused on that because we believe if we can finance those drugs in the areas of the greatest need, you can do well by investors and you can do well for society. Our focus is generally venture creation, as I mentioned earlier. So we will identify an asset that we like, have the discussion, try to acquire it outright, either exclusive license or a pure straight acquisition of it. We build a team around it, seed it with capital, provide it the necessary networks and resources to take it forward, and then let the company grow.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Money is all around us, and we think about it more than almost every other aspect of our lives. But how can we make more of it, and what's our drive for building wealth beyond just the numbers in our bank account? Join us on the Make More podcast as our host Matt Heslin brings to you a dynamic lineup of experts in the world of investing, business, health, and beyond. Together, they unpack the secrets to not just surviving, but thriving in today's economy. It's about more than just wealth. It's about crafting life experiences, seizing opportunities, and building a legacy. Subscribe now to the Make More with Matt Heslin podcast and join us every week for new expert insights and inspiration.
So if I understand you right, you are the perfect match for a scientific founder who thinks he has excellent data, but doesn't want to leave his academic career path and needs someone with the capability of picking up the opportunity and build a team around it and move the asset forward. How early do you go in an opportunity? What data packages would you want to see?
Yeah, so we tend to be looking at drugs that are the earliest IND enabling studies, right? Now, I do get a lot of opportunities that are fairly early on, coming out of universities and things like that. And we, for the most part, because we do have some deals in the pipeline that we're looking at, we primarily focused on that earlier stage with some IND enabling studies. Though, you know, for the right opportunity at the right price point, and we feel like there's strong data to support, you know, something earlier, we may look at that, but that currently falls outside of our scope of investment. And so, like any investment outside that scope, we'd have to kind of get our LPs to kind of weigh on and let's go that route. So there's avenues to do that, but that's kind of our general focus currently.
Maybe I missed the point. You said IND enabling studies. Do you want to have the asset at the beginning of IND enabling studies or completed data packages?
Oh, beginning is fine.
Oh, beginning is fine. So
yeah.
Okay, that's great. I mean, Europe must be a data haven for you then. I mean, basically, this is the big problem we have here. We have world-class grant funding up to the point to the IND enabling studies, and then we have a huge gap. So.
Yeah, I mean, when we looked at specifically Glupus, for example, we looked across the globe, number of European companies. We spoke to a number in the U.S., some in Australia. So, like, we spoke with companies from around the world. And so our goal is to find, you know, the best technology that we feel we can accelerate to get to market, to get new treatments for those with the greatest need.
Do you have a best practice example in your fund already that could explain to interested people?
We just launched. So we're close to, knock on wood, close to doing our first deal. And I don't want to go into that one because it'll be easy to figure out who the parties are.
Yeah, sure. But it's just a fictional story.
I'll just start with like the lupus example, right? So we looked at lupus. We ended up, we identified lupus through a variety of different metrics. We scoured the world. We ended up reviewing close to 250 different products, right? And therapies in a variety of capacities. We ended up speaking to maybe 20 different companies. We diligenced maybe five, but I think two of them, we were like, okay, this particular asset and this particular, your data package, potentially makes sense for us to come in and acquire. And so at that instance, we'll have those conversations when we kind of do our analysis. And our goal is we probably do a more rigorous diligence process or underwriting process than traditional fund, venture fund, because we'll then go in and say, all right, we have this data. What do we need to do to get it from point A to point B? We'll put together, we may say, all right, look, we need to tweak their, you know, their regulatory strategy. What they're doing may not work or may not be the most efficient. So we'll have to put together our own regulatory plan. We have our own IP strategy. We're looking at where they have IP. Are there, they may cover the specific product, but we may say, all right, we think we can expand this to bolster their portfolio. And so there are things that we're doing up front to mitigate that risk before we acquire it. And we've been fortunate in our process is that we do typically bring in specific experts to help us diligence, because we can land on oncology, derm, autoimmune. So we do bring in specific experts in those areas. And at least for the first deal we're looking at, you know, those individuals that helped us diligence the asset, they're coming on. They would come on as the chief medical officer, VP of CMC to lead that company forward. So we have a strong team diligencing the asset, coming up with the right plan. The people that diligence, specifically the experts, they'll come on afterwards and take that plan forward. And so that's our approach.
What's your goal with the companies? You mentioned you licensed the compound into a corporate shell in the United States and then bring on a team. Is your vision for the companies to keep them as a single asset company? So you develop one molecule, one step forward and partner with the pharma industry? Or are you more envisioning larger entities around big problems like big disease areas?
To some extent, it depends on the product, because like some products are pipeline, product by pipeline, pipeline by product. So like you can go after multiple indications. So I was speaking with a company earlier this week. They were like, this is a broad autoimmune drug. And there were 10 different indications that they can go after. They're going after one. They're open to licensing the others out. And so in that instance, you have a pipeline. You have a pipeline of products, their indications that you go after for that one single asset. Others, it might make sense to kind of say, hey, we're a rare disease company, rare disease cell therapy company. And we say, all right, let's bring in multiple assets into that. And I think the goal would be looking at the timeline for exit, which product would exit, and how do we get returns for the investors in an efficient way. So it is to some extent deal by deal to answer that specific question.
I have a business background, so I think it's fantastic today that we can talk about so many different models for companies. When I think back, I read this book recently from Sebastian Malopi to promote it, The Power Law. It's basically the history of venture capital. And Sebastian Malopi, the author, is a journalist, and he did an amazing job in researching the development from the 40s, 50s of venture capital up to now. And a big part of this book is the Genentech story. And I remember it that basically, I think it's middle 40 years ago or 50 years ago, almost, I think 70s, 80s.
Yeah, I think they're launched and created in 70. So, yeah.
And the story in the book is that they basically planned to bring the product to the market and create a larger entity right from the start. And today, we mentioned that you have the possibility to create a larger company depending on the asset, or to make a single asset company and partner it off. I'm interested and curious to hear your perception of the development of the life science industry in venture capital from the Genentech moment up to now. How did you perceive the development from your expertise, from your experience?
I mean, I think biotech life sciences generate great returns for investors. I think more and more people are seeing that. I think, oftentimes though, it's higher checks and longer holding periods, just the nature of how you develop a drug, but the returns in the space have been great. I think people understand that. I think a lot of things oftentimes are cyclical. You know, you're seeing, and so I think what's happening now, big pharma, which were, you know, the great exit avenue for a lot of, you know, smaller biotechs, they're waiting. They have a lot of cash. They're waiting. They're saying, hey, we're going to wait till this particular asset is de-risked. And that may be after phase two, right when you're going into phase three, it's de-risked enough. And they're willing to pay the higher multiple to get that asset, a de-risked asset. And so you're having that. And so what I think what's going to happen is you're going to create this gap. You know, it's like, how do you, the companies that aren't public, like, how are you funding them from IND to phase two? Now, and I do think you'll start to see more VCs, because I think there's going to be more opportunities to invest, start investing in those early stage companies, like pre-phase two. And because they can't go public, at least not right now, and they need access to capital to kind of continue the innovation. And I think the great thing about what's happening, what's going on in life sciences, innovation remains strong. The level of innovation that is coming out of a lot of the companies, a lot of the universities, institutes, is amazing. We just need to, as kind of an investment world, figure out how we can continue to, finance them to kind of get them to the point where you have that inflection where they can raise more capital and take it forward.
I mean, this tool you mentioned, that's the liquid assets in, let's call it this way, in pharma companies are mesmerizing. I had the last time I looked at the BioNTech statement, the quarterly reports, they had liquid assets and short-term assets, about 20 billion in their balance sheet. And the valuation of BioNTech, I mean, it fluctuates, of course, on the market, but it's fluctuates around 20 billion. So basically, the market capitalization equals the short-term assets. And they must acquire something at one point in time. I mean, they are still doing mostly mRNA. And I think an acquisition, I mean, what would they do with the capital?
And BioNTech is obviously doing well with the partnership on the COVID drug. But yeah, and that's not, I don't think that's isolated incident. I think a lot of big pharma, they're just sitting on cash. And I think they're just waiting. They're, you know, waiting for specific assets to get de-risked because they can. And they're going to swoop in and, you know, buy things at a higher multiple. Now, a query, what will happen when multiple big pharma, you know, when those multiples are getting too high, I think, again, things may, they're like, okay, maybe we need to go a little earlier. But we're not there yet. So I think, you know, we'll see how this plays out over the next couple of years.
I mean, you have a gold moment then for LPs, in my opinion. You have, on the one hand, at the end of the value chain, you have capital sitting, waiting for assets. The IPO window probably will open up again in 24, 25, 26, somewhere around. Yeah. And now the valuations are very low. So if, in my opinion, it sounds like a great opportunity for LPs.
Absolutely. I should bring you on my pitches. Absolutely.
Opinion, I mean, you talk with many LPs. In your opinion, is the opportunity understood or does it take some more groundwork?
Yeah. No, I think the opportunity is understood. I think, again, the bigger issue is the asset allocation problem, where they're taking on new managers at this time, given where they're at. Mm-hmm. So, but yeah, I don't think, I mean, the numbers are the numbers, right? Like I could look at how large the opportunities we're looking to invest in. This is what's happening in the IPO market. These are the number of CEOs that are actively saying they're going to divest opportunity. We know there's opportunity to acquire products at a discount. We know in 3 to 5 years, the IPO and that the market from M&A perspective is going to bounce back. And we know that big pharma, they have, again, $200 billion of revenue at risk tied to patent expiration without having the complete pipeline. So they got gaps in their pipeline. And so that story, it doesn't take much to people to understand. The question is, Are you right team to do it? Are you right team to take it forward? How is that asset allocation issue for LPs?
200 billion is the risk of patent expiration.
Yeah, at risk. Pharma. Yep. And it's probably higher. I mean, that's, yeah. I mean, the number specifically, I think, was 170 billion in the next 7 years. But yeah, it's a lot. And that's just through generics coming on the market and, you know, depleting the value of the revenue for those
companies. So there's not only capital sitting on the bank accounts, there's also a little bit of a patent cliff.
A patent cliff is absolutely
desperate for CEOs of public companies, desperate moments they're looking at.
Oh, absolutely. I've been part of companies where it wasn't necessarily the patent cliff, or it was like, hey, we knew. It was less the patent cliff, but we knew like, hey, competitors were coming in on this date, and you have to fill the pipeline behind it years ahead of schedule to figure that out, so that when that does happen, or if it does happen, you don't have a significant blip in your revenues.
We mentioned in our conversation, we mentioned a lot of partnerships with big pharma, with venture capitalists, with universities. When we bring the conversation back to health equity and health disparities, what partners do you need to change that in the value chain?
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Coaching Conversation 2024. This podcast is 100% dedicated to leadership and leadership within the workplace coaching area. We work with companies throughout the world teaching leaders how to coach their employees. This podcast is dedicated to teaching specific strategies, frameworks, coaching models, and now artificial intelligent strategies to help leaders drive greater teamwork, collaboration, cooperation, greater attitudes, better motivation, coaching career development, just to name a few. I hope you'll check out our podcast.
So, I don't know, there's this quote that says, if you want to go fast, go alone. If you want to go far, go together. It's health equity is such a big issue. It requires unified action. Like you need partners. And because, just looking at the four or five social determinants of health, access to quality care. So access to care, quality care. You have education, economic stability, environment, where people live, and, you know, pollution around, and then community engagement. You know, I'm a fund, right? We're focused on the quality of care and making sure we have products in the area where there's the most needed. But if you're trying to move the needle on health equity, you need government policies to come in. You need, you know, that's federal and state. You need churches and communities to share opportunities for clinical trials, address the, you know, definitely in the Black community, the mistrust of the health, you know, the warranted mistrust of kind of healthcare in the United States. You need nonprofits, hospital systems, right? Like I've seen, and I just went and got my an annual physical. And they actually, there's a whole questionnaire on social determinants of health. Ask the questions. And so you need to have these concerted efforts across a variety of different organizations and institutions to try to bend that. To move the needle. And I say, like, I call health equity social justice in healthcare. And it always takes me back to like a Dr. King. So, you know, the Arkwright and Moore universe is long, but you're trying to bend it to some extent toward justice, right? And so it's going to take concerted effort to bend that arc, social justice, towards social justice in healthcare.
Where do you see your role with Zurich Bio? Are you more focusing on staying focused on the mission of moving assets forward to the market? Or are you also expanding your perspective to the more charity work that's necessary to get communities on board and to help also with the groundwork?
So right now we're singularly focused on the fund and focused on investing in specific diseases. And I think we need to be to kind of, so our, the broad thing, what we're doing is really harnessing capitalism, right? People want to make money. and directing it to health equity. And I think they work well. You can do good and do well by harnessing, by investing in a way that ultimately can have an impact on some of those social determinants of health. We do get asked the question around, because we specifically focus on therapies, are we going to branch out to diagnostics, different other companies that will address those other pillars and the social determinants? And maybe in a next fund, because we do think it still fits under our purview of accelerating achieving health equity. And I think maybe again, that's a second fund, but I do think there's a path to broaden our scope at some point in the future to continue to address the needs from a capitalistic way to kind of push the needle forward. Now, what you were specifically asking was on the community development, things like that. I do think look, if there's opportunities to that, in the future, we can maybe cross that bridge later. But right now, the reality is we're an investment firm and we have to invest in a way that gets returns for strong returns for our investors. I think the other things in partnering with our other organizations and nonprofits are not out the wheelhouse from our perspective quite yet, though.
I'm hoping for politics, for support of politicians. I mean, when I look at the big health problems that we have today, I mean, mostly they are diseases, and I understand your mission as a venture fund. You need products. So basically, you need products to invest in, to bring to market. Everything in our economy is centered around the product solution, which is quite clear and which is good. When I look at the health problems at the root causes, especially with the messages coming these days from the longevity field, there is an interesting documentary on Netflix about the blue zones, and the author of the book was basically doing some research, what influences longevity and which lifestyle changes help to stay healthier longer, and crossing the line to needing the healthcare system later in life. So the health span basically increases, which in Europe is much needed, because we cannot finance a fair system for everybody from early age on, from diabetic diseases due to poor lifestyle habits with our society in their 20s already and 50 years in the healthcare system. The question that I'm pondering is, when we look at sleep, for example, people in my environment are very often overworked, they lack sleep. When we could change that and we could raise the awareness, probably we have also a positive impact. Alcohol, drugs, illegal drugs, for example. What's your take on that? How should we address these problems that could benefit people? How do we get these messages out on the market that people learn to understand how important lifestyle is?
No, I think it goes back to education. We just need to, and it's different forms, whether it's in schools, whether it's in community, whether it's in churches, synagogues, mosques, what have you, have that conversation with your constituents. And we have to educate. Now, look, you can bring people to the water, but you can't make them drink it, right?
Unfortunately.
And so that's the thing, right? I can tell someone, hey, you have diabetes, you need to cut back on your sugar, you're going to have to get dialysis, your kidney's going to go. But if they don't make that change for themselves, I can't do it for them, right? And so you kind of run into that issue. So you want to be able to educate them. You want to be able to address some of the structural barriers that make it difficult for them to a lot of times, do make healthy lifestyle choices, right? And you just, it's a continual effort. But I think you're right. There are some things that us as individuals need to do to be healthy. And we have to make the conscious decision to do those things.
Yeah, we solved with the industrial food, we solved a lot of problems. When I think back to my grandparents who grew up in Europe after World War II, where everything was destroyed, they were happy when they got something to eat. We fixed that and opened another can of worms, basically, in our society. And hopefully we can also change that for the better. My question to you around this topic is, in the last 3 years, I saw a lot of adoption of AI and social media search engines in the venture world and also in the big pharma world. For example, Zoom calls and conversations like we have. When I addressed this idea in 2019 to colleagues from the pharma industry or venture capitalists, they looked at me and said, why should we do that? Nobody needs that. And now when I ask people if they are willing to join my podcast, I think 90% say yes immediately and are happy to share their story. How do you see the impact of social media, artificial intelligence in your work?
Yeah, so I would say this. It is... I think AI is a tool. I don't think AI is, from a life sciences perspective, drug development is going to significantly replace individuals in the development that's happening. Though I do think individuals that know how to use AI will replace those that don't know how to use AI.
Oh, really?
Makes sense. Yeah, because like it's a tool. If you're not good at using this tool to analyze massive amounts of data, then it can be an issue, right? If no one wanted to use a computer, computer's a tool, email, and if you're not trained on how to use these new tools, I think it'll be a detriment to folks in the future. So I think people need to understand them, learn how to use them, but I do think that they are just a tool. I do think they will have the ability to advance drug development, finding unique areas where, from a drug, just creating new drugs, identifying new markers, things like that. I think it'll be used there, but people just need to learn how to use it and use it efficiently and effectively. And I think it's going to hit multiple different industries. So I think it's going to hit finance at some point, and how that plays out, we'll see. Definitely in the life sciences space, AI. People have been using AI in life sciences for years now, so this isn't particularly new. But I think it's more front and center now because of ChatGPT and other AI engines like that.
Do you feel an impact in your work already? Do you use ChatGPT for your venture capital work?
Yeah, sometimes I do. Right, it's like, you know, drafting, you know, emails, researching specific topics. Now, look, the thing is, you have to trust it, right? You got to trust, but verify what they're saying.
That's true.
You know, the guy, it's funny. I saw a lawyer used ChatGPT to write a brief. And I think all the citations for the legals were wrong. And so I was like, you can't rely on it. That's why I say it's a tool. Has it helped me identify specific assets and molecules to go after? No, not in that perspective. So administrative stuff it helps with, but nothing critical in identifying the asset, understanding where there are risks, how do you mitigate them? What's the best way to put together a plan? Because sometimes it's going to be tied to the specific asset, understanding the nuance of how these things play throughout, having someone that worked at the FDA that can advise you. So like, there's so many things that go into our underwriting process that, you know, that we would never rely on AI, at least not now, to help us with.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think these tools like ChatGPT, I mean, the funny thing is they are more human than I imagined them to be. Making things up, hallucinating. Another speaker on my podcast said hallucinating. They sometimes hallucinate and just make things up. I mean, out of nowhere.
That's right. And I'm curious to see how this all evolves because, you know, the more people use it, the more data that's out there, it's going to get better and it's going to continue to get better. So we'll see how this plays out in the next couple of years.
How do you see the necessity these days to use tools like podcast, for example, to be present? I mean, the processes, as I understood them before 2020, were pretty simple. Go to conferences, meet VCs, build relationship with VCs if you want to partner an asset, meet the industry in person. And now we have a lot of novel tools besides artificial intelligence. There are a lot of podcasts, for example, out there on the market, and people create more and more content. Is this really relevant in our industry, or do you think it's just a fun
game? I think so. The content is king, right? That's the value of a lot of tech companies and what have you. And it's valuable because people can learn what's going on in real time from experts by having these types of conversations. And, for me, like, people now can hear more about me, more about my fund, how I think about things, what I'm doing to try to address these larger address larger issues in society. And I think all that plays into, even from a marketing standpoint, just pure marketing, being able to, if I can't visit you in person, but people can get to see me in a conversation like this, that's another data point that they have that can help them make a decision, right? And so I think these are absolutely valuable, absolutely important for funds, for folks that are trying to grow their footprint online or in whatever area they're trying to grow their footprint in.
It's really interesting because before the pandemic, I had a lot of attempts to use tools like podcasts, but everybody in my environment ignored it. And when I asked people, around conferences, for example, Bio International or Bio Europe here in Europe, how do you use these conferences? The usual process was I register for the conference, then I use the partnering tool, I update my profile, and then I look who's there. Yeah. And depending on the search area, I find companies, and then I read how they present themselves, and then I agree on meetings. And there was a subtle nuance that happened between 2020 and 2023, when I ask people about their search process, they say pretty much the same up to the partnering tool. And then they have a new step. They say, and when I find the company interesting, then I look into search engines. And then this happens, what you mentioned, they look for data points outside the partnering system. And this is completely new.
Absolutely. People do that all the time. You're interviewing people. Like, the first thing you do is like, all right, Google, like, you have their resume, you have the data that you're going to have a conversation with them, but you Google them, see what shows up. Right. And so you use those different search engines to check LinkedIn, see what they're talking about. And I think, because those you have limited data, whether it's in an interview or whether you're looking at the information that's updated, and usually those are in the best light, right? You're on your A game in an interview, right? When you're interviewing for a job. But let's see what else is out there that can help me make a better informed decision on who you are as a person. Yeah. So I think you're absolutely right. A lot of people, I just went to a conference and even the tools, they have like links to, to get the email, you search, you see the profile, but it's a link to their website, right? You can go to the website. So it's outside of the tool. You check out the website, or you can just Google them. And so it just helps me make the decision. Okay. Do I want to speak with them? Do I not? Do I have time? And just prioritize things a little bit better.
How do you see that these days? Just also a story from my past. I mean, whatever I posted on Facebook, nobody was interested in it professionally in the pharma industry before 2020. And now people pull out posts from 10, 15 years ago. When you look at your professional work, do you really look that far back? I mean, what happens in you when you search for a person and you find nothing? There is nothing on social media. There is a website with a picture and that's it.
Yeah, I don't know. You can usually, it is interesting. If there's nothing out there, you can usually find something. But then the reality is you just have less data to go off of to make a decision, right? Mm-hmm. It's not like, they say if you want to hide something, hide it on the second page of a search engine, right? Like, you're not a lot of times digging that significantly that deep to figure out where's everything that's out there on that particular individual. But if it's out there, it's out there. It's also, it, people can find it. And it, sometimes it's like, okay, it's indication. Like if something is, that's way out there, it gets out there, it's indication of like judgment. But if it was when you were a teenager, maybe you discount it, right? Because like, you may have been 13, right? Something happened then. But you're making it. So, but it's a data point that you now have, you kind of have to factor that in, but some things just get discounted. I'm not necessarily digging deep to get their whole life story most times, at least not me.
Yeah. But I think it's a great tool. I mean, so it's just 10 years ago, this was only possible for people like Jeff Bezos, Elon Musk to present themselves on media, and the average person had no chance. And I think the downside of that was, when you send a CV or a pitch deck to someone, you can believe it or you can't. I mean, there's a lot of stuff in a CV and there's a lot of stuff in pitch decks, but how can you prove the truth of the history of the person? Now, when they start documenting their life on social media, the only thing they need to do 5 years or 10 years down the road and say, look at my social media profiles. Everything is there. And you can see the timestamps, you can see the interviews I did at this time. And this, I think, will help tremendously in future to overcome this trust hurdle in the beginning of a relationship.
Absolutely. Like I was talking to someone recently and I was saying like raising capital, it's about relationships and trust. And you know, that's tied to credibility. And credibility somewhat correlated to visibility, right? And so like if you are more visible and out there speaking on an expert on specific topics, there's more credibility now tied to you. They may trust you a little bit more because I can see that you are an expert in whatever area that it is, and you have a track record of X, Y, and Z. And so it's granted, sometimes, you know, the individual has control over what they're putting out there and things like that, but it's different from I'm in an interview, sending you a pitch deck, here are the things that I did. And they can independently verify it from, you know, 5-6 other sources. So there's a difference in those two scenarios.
That's true. But I mean, you can't fake interviews. I mean, when you do one interview or when you record yourself 2 minutes on camera, of course, I mean, you can put your marketing messages or your A game. You mentioned the A game out there. But when you sit with 10, 15 podcasters similar to Joe Rogan and you discuss challenging topics over 2 or 3 hours, it's really challenging to keep that under control.
You'll get the real you. You'll get that real person at some point, at some level in that conversation.
Definitely. I mean, this is the feeling that I got with the development of the internet. I thought always, where is this thing heading to? And one conclusion that I have drawn is that people want to see the reality. They don't want to see the A game of the person, because when you live with a person or when you basically work day and night with a person on a company for 5 years, you rarely get their A game. So you also experience the B and the C and the D game. And these are the interesting days then. How do they behave when they are under pressure? And I think this is the reason why I said, let's put it on, let's live stream every podcast that we do and just show people how we are, unmasked, how the reality looks like. And I think this has power.
No, absolutely. 1000% agree.
When we go back to the equality questions, there is one point that I would love to discuss with you and would love to hear your opinion on that. In Europe, we talk a lot about equality in founding teams and on the VC landscape in terms of ethnicity and gender equality. How do you see the situation around these topics in the United States?
And I'll tie it to like VC funding, and it's frustrating to say the least, right? So, and I'm going to probably butcher some of these numbers, but they're generally accurate. I think Black founder companies in the United States, 1% of them make it VC funding, or the 1% of the VC market funds Black founders, 1%. Women, if it's Black women, is less than 1%. If it's women broadly, it's somewhere between 2 and 3%. And I can't think of, granted, you know, I can't think of a large organization that grew to where they needed to be without venture funding. Right. And so if you have less than 2%, less than 1% of a specific community getting VC funding, it's limiting their ceiling on what they can achieve for their company. Right. I think as a group, we, you know, just investors, we need to do better. And because look, and this is not, you know, the morality of it. This is like dollars and cents. Data has shown that more diverse teams perform better, right? You got to also think that there's no monopoly on good ideas. So like investors can make money, or we're leaving money on the table by not looking at and not seriously investing in, you know, women-led companies, diverse, you know, Black and brown CEOs and led companies. You were leaving money on the table. And I think a lot more work needs to be done in that space. And I know, in Europe, but US, we had a gentleman just sue this Fearless Fund. I know you've been tracking this. You know, they had this litigation with around affirmative action, and they kind of struck that down. And that same gentleman now was suing the Fearless Fund because they focus on giving out, you know, investment to Black women-led companies. Now, we need to fight it. We need to stand strong. And I think they have strong arguments to win that case. But if there's any silver lining that can be had there, is that my hope will be that it will bring to the forefront those numbers, like to see people, this to show people what they're fighting over, right? That if less than 1% of the VC market or VC investments are going into Black women, and people are trying to strike that down, let's have that conversation, all right? Because then maybe we can go into the root causes of why less than 1% Black women founded led companies are actually getting these types of investments, VC investments. So I think there's a lot more work to be done. I think people were leaving money on the table by not specifically addressing that issue. I'll get off my soapbox because it is a little frustrating for me to see that.
Can we dive deep in the topic or would you like to move on?
No, we keep talking. Yeah.
Yeah. You mentioned Fearless Fund. What's the story behind it? You said there is something going on.
Yeah, Fearless Fund is a Black woman led fund. And they invest in Black women founded companies. And that is their focus. You know, to me, like if you're making investors the requested return or needed returns, like go do that. But the reality is, they got sued because the argument is that they're discriminating. Like you can't distribute certain types of cash grants, especially if you get federal dollars and things like that, in a way that uses race as the primary driver. And that is, so they're arguing that, hey, look, they shouldn't be able to invest directly or solely or primarily through or to Black women founded companies. So that's the overarching thing. And so I think we'll see how this ultimately plays out. I track it here and there. I know the judge just ruled that they could still, for now, give out grants to Black women founded companies or Black women founders and do things like that. But I'm curious to see how this ultimately plays out in the long run.
So this Fearless Fund, if I understood you right, distributes tax money in form of grants to fix the problem.
Wasn't it necessarily tax money? And I don't want to get into the weeds. I don't necessarily know if they're taking federal government, but they have a fund where they invest in Black women-led companies. Okay. That I can't tell. I don't know who their LPs are. Yeah.
They collect basically capital and try to fix the problem that companies led by Black women usually don't get funding. So 99% of the capital is allocated in the typical white male founder. If I got the numbers right.
That's fair.
And they wanted to fix this problem and got sued for that.
Yeah, exactly.
But what's the point?
Yeah, you tell me. I don't know. Like, I wish, I don't know the gentleman who's doing the suit. I think I won't speak. I won't give his name, but he's generally on a crusade to broadly, in a variety of different institutions, challenge race-based decisions. Challenge race-based decisions. So he just does not like the fact that decisions can be made on race. He's using the courts to kind of challenge a variety of different areas. And it's not just in finance. He did it in, colleges, universities. He's going after other industries, law firms. I think some law firms got sued for some of their diversity programs. And so he's just challenging multiple areas. That's just his mission in life.
But for the investment rationale, you mentioned that, we leave money on the table. Can you give a little bit more background to this thought? Why do funds and companies leave money on the table when they usually invest in the white male teams and don't create diverse teams?
My position is that there's no monopoly on good ideas, right? So I don't know what the number is, 12%, 15% African-American or Black Americans in the United States. Or 50% women, right? If let's use the gender conversation, if 50% women and 50% men, and we're all generating good ideas, but only 2% of those women and 98% of the men get funded, right? The connection is you're leaving something on the, you're leaving good ideas that you can invest in on the table. Our fund, we focus on, obviously we're venture creation, so we build teams and our aim is to build diverse teams. And the diverse teams, it's centered around the fact that research has shown diverse teams perform better. I'm trying to make money for my investors. Right. And so that's our focus. I think that's going back to your point, why there are things being left on the table. That's why I believe there's a good ideas being left on the table.
No, I totally agree. I had an experience almost 20 years ago. And when you want to understand a market, you need to have people on the team, because otherwise you will never understand the market. I was working for a mobile company back then for a special project and had the responsibility of handset sales. So it's basically mobile phone sales. And as a man, I said, okay, it needs technically and Black phones and it's okay. And then the marketing people said, but we also need to address women and we need different types of handsets. And I said, why? Why do we need that? Why do we need pink and glittery handsets? And they said, because women buy that. So I asked women, do you buy that? I would never buy that. And they simply said, yes. And I learned, I'm blind in this area. So yeah. I don't understand.
Everyone has blind spots. Everyone, right? That's why you need that diverse team, because there are things that I know I don't see. There are things that I'm other folks on my team might not see, but everyone has blind spots. And that's the value. That's why diverse teams tend to perform better, because everyone's coming with their different perspective, their different view on things, their different lens in which they're analyzing and synthesizing data.
It's the, I listened to a podcast lately. It was the founder of Spotify and he was on the Steve Bartlett show, The Diary of a CEO. And he mentioned that basically there's nothing innovative in this world. And usually it's coming, a few people coming together, taking two or three ideas and packaging in a new way. And this is, I think also it's a strong case for diverse teams. You need to get these ideas together to create something new.
Yeah, absolutely.
But how can we fix that? How can we, I mean, when you say we just, when we invest, we just look at 90, we allocate 98% of the capital in probably 10% of market ideas. It's not a correct number probably, but it's just to emphasize the problem. So the majority of the capital goes to 10% of the ideas.
Funds in general, they just need to take a broader view on what's in their scope of investment and who have these good ideas. They just need to do the hard work in identifying the best deals possible, regardless of who's at the top. And I venture to say it would be better than, 2% women-led companies or 3%, whatever the number is. But you have to do the hard work. You have to build the relationships in the areas and the communities and the companies in which you're looking to invest. And, I think if you do that, you'll get the best companies. It's my job to go out and find the best opportunities to invest, right? It's my job to build the best teams. So I have Black, Asian, white, Indian. My network is relatively broad, and we have to have that broad purview as we're building teams or as we're investing in companies and having those relationships where, they know they have access to, the fund that they're looking to kind of seek funds from, or they have relationships with. I'm saying before, funding and getting investments is a lot of times it's about relationships and credibility and trust. And, if you don't know the VC funds and the VC funds aren't going out and talking to those groups and, being present in the communities where they need to kind of grow, they're just going to miss out on opportunities. The goal is to make money. And so I think it's incumbent upon us to go out and do the hard work to bring stronger returns for our investors.
I think this is the rule number one for companies and investors, whether we like it or not, but the purpose of companies and investors is to make money. So one of the important purposes. When we stay a little bit longer at this diversity question, is it a selection question? I mean, when you look at your deal flow, do you see diversity in the teams coming to you? Do you see women, yes, Black women, Asian women, Asian men? So is it more a selection problem that VCs need to learn or investors and LPs need to learn to leave their own biases and to cause
it? So it's probably a little different. Ours is health equity. And so when you look at some of the funds that are doing health equity, a lot of it's centric around, diverse founders. Ours isn't necessarily centered around diverse founders. It's around specific disease areas. But we probably get over-indexed because we have health equity as our tagline, right? So we tend to get more Black and Brown founders. Now, in saying that, we make decisions off the science, right? So the three criteria we're looking at for our investment is, obviously, it has to have a health equity case. So we're investing in a disease where there's a big disparity. Scientific, pretty credible scientific and clinical data. Then it has to have a strong business case. Those are the three things we're looking at. And I think when you're making that call, and again, I appreciate our model is different because we're buying specific products. And that's why I kind of harp on that we're building diverse teams. Now, diverse teams, you have to have that strong network of CEOs and what have you. And if I'm part of a group, and I am part of a group that's, it's Black male executive in biotech, right? It's like a compliment to, there's a similar group for Black women in biotech. I have access to them. I know them. I have personal relationships with them. I go to dinner, I go to coffee. So, my first reaction, if I'm like, I'm looking for a high, I'm talking to that group, not necessarily to stem from them, saying, hey, who do you know would be a good fit? And they may give me folks that they're going to give me folks in their network. And I have other similar groups. And, I attend a lot of events in Princeton and New Jersey and PA and Pennsylvania as well. And I'm looking, the people that I'm looking at, they're going to be centered in that, in those regions. Right. And so, we're centered on obviously building diverse teams, but on the, where we're selecting assets, it's a strong science. Is it a strong business case? Does we have good clinical data? Does it fit within our investment thesis?
Yeah, that's the right approach. When we look at your investment style, I have two questions. One that popped up while you were speaking. So you look at the science, and you're based in the United States, but you look globally for opportunities. So you're not just focused on the United States. Basically, it also includes then Europe, Africa, South America, Asia, Australia. Did we have everything?
Australia, yeah.
And Antarctica is maybe missing, but I don't think that there is a university there. Maybe you're not yet. What's your approach? Do you invest then also outside the United States, or do you pull the asset to the United States?
We would pull the asset to the United States. So the assets, when we talk about assets, it's usually IP. So it's patents, know-how, data, right? That's what we're typically acquiring. It's not necessarily wedded to being solely set up in the US. That's our strong suit, right? The team is generally currently built with US-centric individuals on the team. And so it's easier for us to set up a Delaware company, New Jersey company, Pennsylvania company, what have you, and just get things set up easily and to raise raise funds in the United States. That's where our network is the strongest for the portfolio companies to help them grow. To answer that question, it's probably we will acquire products from anywhere in the world, but the companies that we create will likely be set up in the United States.
Mm-hmm. I learned recently from a business angel from the Los Angeles area. He was on my podcast in February that there are some tax advantages for investors when they invest in the United States.
Yeah, everything's tax driven, right? Like, a lot of things are tax driven in this line of work.
This is logical. When you acquire assets, I think then you have two models then basically that you can use in license or acquisition of the IP. And your preferred model is to have basically just the asset and no team attached. What happens when you see an interesting asset and you have three people who say, okay, but we want to be part of the founding team and we are willing to move to the United States?
Yeah, I mean, there's flexibility there, right? So, you know, I've done, like, outside of the fund, I've done a number of deals similar to product acquisitions. And usually whether it's a transition services agreement where you keep those people on that have the know-how that can help, you know, alleviate a slowdown in clinical development because they still have knowledge. And so we do have to work closely with those partners and those people, and whether it's bringing them on to the new company or whether it's we have a consulting relationship with them, we still need their input. So it's not like we're just, hey, wiping our hands, you guys can go your separate way, we go ours. That's not the case. We do need to work with their partners, right? And we treat them as such.
So basically you're also looking for teams who are willing to contribute. The projects usually are complex. It's not like buying a car as a simple transaction and then you can use the car. So there's a lot of expertise that's not documented in the patents and you need to understand how things worked. So basically you would like to see that people still have the will to stay engaged.
Absolutely. I think, and so like in some instances, you know, it's a little bit easier because they may be using the CRO, CDMO that will take over that relationship, right? And so, or they were using a consultant in some capacity, and we can just contract with that consultant. There's going to be an overlap, and there has to be some knowledge sharing for a period of time for us to get things off the ground efficiently.
This is the one question that I love asking VCs. Usually I pitch to VCs so I cannot turn the table and say, why should people come to you? Why should they choose to pitch their opportunity to your fund, to you, to your team, given that they are in your sweet spot and not pitch to 30 other VCs? What makes you unique?
So unique from a company looking to divest their asset to us?
Yes.
Okay.
Why are you the best fit?
From a sourcing perspective. Yeah. I mean, I think our track record will kind of speak to that, right? We have a relatively strong track record of company creation. If you look at our advisors and our team, you know, from company creation, five, six companies created, the the multiples on returns on capital range up to probably averaging four to somewhere, you know, average around 4x, 5x return on investment, not including milestones and some royalty payments that are continuing to be paid. So we have a strong track record. I think people, you're doing this, you're buying into teams, right? And do we have the capabilities to take that asset and get it from point A to point B efficiently and effectively so you can get a return on your, you know, I mean, because if this is your baby, this is your asset that you want to get forward, you know, you want to see it get commercialized. And so we built a team and a network of folks that can do that. And so that's my pitch. And obviously you get to do well, do good while you're doing it, right? And we're focused on, again, at the end of the day, accelerating health equity. And that's our mission. And that's what we're focused on. And, you know, we track or we're figuring out from the impact standpoint, is it disease adjusted life years? Is it how much money are we attracting to this interesting technology or this interesting space? And so those are the things that when companies are looking to kind of out-license their assets, they're gonna hopefully they'll see that we have those that expertise and experience to do.
So when I understood you well and right and listened closely, then the team, you're looking for teams that have a preclinical asset and basically need someone who knows how to turn a preclinical asset into clinical value. And the teams usually coming from the scientific side have limited expertise in clinics, and you close the gap with funding and with access to the right people.
Exactly. Exactly.
We are at the beginning of the conference season here in Europe, and we have some conferences coming up, and I usually use the podcasts whenever I see someone looking for investors or syndicate partners. I give them the podcast link and say, look at this podcast. You might find something of value in there. My question to you is specifically centered around the fourth quarter of 2023. Which areas currently in the next quarter are you most passionate about? So when we look at indications, what is your focus area right now for the next quarter?
Our focus is, it's lupus, sickle cell. Those are the two biggest ones. We're looking at some assets in sarcoidosis as well, but those are the top ones. And we're looking at a couple of lupus assets now. Sickle cell is another one that we think there's some interesting technology out there as well. Those are probably the top ones.
Do we have a second filter? So you have lupus and sickle cell, and is there a second technological filter, or is it broad then?
No, it could be cell therapy, it could be biologics, it could be small molecules. From that perspective, it doesn't necessarily matter. We narrow down broadly on like autoimmune disorders, like as our first therapeutic area that we're focused on. But yeah, those are, we'll take a look at what's effective, what we think will actually work. And so again, a lot of that's going to come down to the data. What does the data say? And we'll get into the weeds of what that looks like. And then we'll make, especially like on disease areas where we know what the market is, we'll make, at that point, our decisions really dictated by can we get access to them, to the asset, and then do they have strong scientific or clinical data?
That's great. So basically you are also open, you invest currently, so you're looking for assets actively, and yeah, you're happy to receive pitch decks. What's the best way to approach you?
I mean, they can connect with me, go to my website, ceridexbio.com. That's one way. I don't know if we can drop it in the chat or if we could put it in after this gets posted. Connecting with me, I'm pretty active on LinkedIn as well. I'm pretty responsive through emails. I usually transition from LinkedIn to my work email. And then also they can just email me at my work. And we could also put that hopefully at the end here in some capacity on your site, so we can share that as
well.
Yeah,
definitely. I usually use the LinkedIn profiles because they give a little bit more information about the person compared to the email address. But when you're active on LinkedIn, so DM, direct message.
That's probably the easiest way.
Yeah. When we look at the future of ZurichExpio, how do you envision the future of your fund?
I mean, I want to be a leader in accelerating health equity. And I think that obviously performing well, having strong exits, but investing in a way that where we feel like there's areas of greatest need. I think I would love to in the future expand our purview, not just therapies. It's, you know, diagnostics, it's med device, med tech, you know, digital health, right? So I would love to expand because I do think there are, I mean, even some services, there are a lot of opportunities in areas where from a business case, I think it would, you know, investing in those companies makes sense, but also what they're doing can address one of those social determinants. So I'd love to kind of continue to grow and just be a leader in this space.
Yeah, this makes sense. I mean, what is therapeutics without diagnostics? Right. Yeah. You need to solve two problems. What's the most rewarding aspect of your work at ZurichExpio?
Oh, I wake up every day, focus on the issue that I'm passionate about, right? That's the answer. So, you know, I'm excited every day when I wake up that, you know, my hope is that what I'm doing is meaningful to society and that can bring returns for obviously our investors. Because if we execute on a strategy effectively, you know, society will benefit. And so that's what I'm excited about.
There's one particular problem that I often hear from young founders, that they start something, are very passionate about the area, and 6 to 9 months down the road, they hit the wall for the first time. And some find it particularly hard to learn that entrepreneurship and investing is nothing different than entrepreneurship. Yeah. It's a special kind of being an entrepreneur. And they learn that entrepreneurship basically is hard and it's sometimes really challenging to move forward. My question to you is, what's your recipe for success to overcome such days? I mean, hardship will come on the entrepreneurial journey. What's your recipe?
I mean, well, I think one thing is, the good thing is, like, this wasn't, hey, I'm just going to go out and start a fund. This was 10 years, a decade in the making, right? And so that's one thing. So it's like I come in somewhat eyes wide open what it takes to kind of get it off the ground. But then probably the better answer is just consistency, right? We have a plan, consistently every day, get a win, right? And that's my focus. You know, we have the plan and then we got our tactics that we're executing. And every day, my goal is to get a small win. I don't care how big it is. If we get a win every day for 365, you'll start to build that momentum up. And so you will hit roadblocks. I know it's difficult. It's a tough environment to raise capital, but consistency, consistency, consistency every day, continue to push that boulder up the hill. And so that's my focus. You know, control what I can control and just be consistent every day.
So basically it's a strong testament for the hustle culture. It's basically get to work.
Yeah, let's get to work. Yeah, exactly.
So there's no way around it. It's basically hard work and you need to put the work in, and no matter how hard it is, just keep pressing.
Exactly. There's no shortcut for success. There's no shortcut. And so, you know, and people that think that it's going to be easy or there's going to be some easy way around, I think you're right. They'll get to that rock. And, you know, then it's difficult. They have to make a decision. Am I going to stop? Am I going to keep going? And so, you know, it's, you know, for me, you got that passion behind that mission that I'm focused on. And then just every day, continue to be consistent and get those small wins every day.
I'm looking at my questions and we're coming to the final part of our recording and this final set of questions. Before I ask them, I would like to ask you, is there a special topic that you would like to address in the final part of our conversation that we didn't talk about?
No, I think this was a pretty fulsome conversation.
When we look at the future, and mostly my final questions are centered around the future and advice, health equity. What's the future of health equity in your opinion? How do you envision the future? in that area?
It's going to continue to be a main topic for some time. I think COVID significantly brought it to the forefront. I think definitely you have health equity officers, health equity offices. I mean, the federal, state. And so like they're now institutionalizing, at least talking about and having that conversation about health equity. And I think it's going to continue to be a growing issue in the United States and globally that my hope is that people bring up in every different area of their institutions. And how do you address it from an HR perspective? How do you address it from a legal perspective? How do you address it from a business model perspective? My hope is that more companies, more funds are thinking about it the way I'm thinking about it, as far as how they like to invest in issues and invest in interesting technology. So I don't think it's going anywhere anytime soon. And my hope is it continues to stay at the forefront of people's minds as they tackle various issues in their lives.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I hope we continue building a global family and tear down borders and walls and not continue building walls. I think since 2020, the world shifted a little bit more towards nationalism and away from globalism. And I hope we find our way back.
Yeah, absolutely.
When we look at the young generation that's currently thinking about their most important life choices, we are coming into fall and people start something new, end of school, college. What's your advice to someone who wants to make an impact in life science?
Oh, man. Focus on the fundamentals, right? Yeah, and this is for folks that are like doing R&D and research. It's, you know, and I can't take claim for this as a gentleman by the name of Ted Love. He's like, focus on the three P's, especially if you're at a company. It's penny, so managing the budget, being capital efficient, product, having good scientific and clinical data, and people, hiring good people. If you focus on those fundamentals, I think you'll and be consistent at it, I think you'll be well served in your careers. There's a lot of things are happening in society and different, but the reality is fundamentals don't change. Like I invest in, like, obviously I do life sciences. And that's why I say like the innovation is still strong. Fundamentals didn't change, right? Like, Data is good data, and you have a good product, good technology. If you find those diamonds in the rough, or not so in the rough, right? You'll be able to create good value and do something meaningful for society.
Yeah, that's true. When we look at the broader mission of Zurich Bio, health equity. Listeners can contribute on one hand by pitching opportunities to you, but what's your advice to them when they want to help your mission or from a broader perspective and help change the communities to become more aware of gender equality, equality generally speaking, and also health equity? How can they do that?
Share that this is an issue, that health equity is something that's not going away. Share that there's ways to invest in a way that, you know, you can address this issue while getting, targeted, potentially great returns. And then there's a way to kind of do good and do well by addressing it, and then direct them my way. And then I'll chat with them.
That's great. I'm at the end of my questions. It was a pleasure talking to you. And
pleasure.
I loved learning a lot more about the situation of health equity in the United States and in the world. And let's keep building a better world for our children, I would say.
No, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you for joining my podcast. I wish you a great weekend and have a great time.
Thank you. You too.
See you soon. Bye-bye. That concludes the profound discussion with Squire Servants. Today, we explored the vital role of venture capital in advancing health equity, the importance of diversity in fostering innovation, and strategic approaches to addressing health disparities through impactful investments. Thank you for joining in and contributing to this meaningful dialogue. If this episode inspired you, please help spread these crucial messages. I appreciate your likes and comments on platforms like Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Your positive feedback not only motivates the team behind the show, but also elevates visibility, helping others gain access to these invaluable conversations. And remember, sharing is powerful. Pass this episode along to peers, colleagues, or anyone in your network who might benefit from hearing about transformative venture capital strategies. Your support is key to continuing to bring in visionary speakers like Squire Serrins, enhancing our collective understanding and impact in this world. Stay tuned for more insightful episodes. Until next time, keep pushing the boundaries of what's possible and strive for a healthier, happier, and more equitable world.